Hello, everyone. I am talking to Stephanie Burgess, who is here in the UK with me, but she is in Wales and I am in London. Do you want to say hi to everybody?
Hi. Hi, everybody.
So Stephanie Burgess, for those of you who don't know, is the author of The Unladylike Adventures of Cat Stevenson. That's her novel series. She's also had quite a long career as a short story author. But why don't we begin by talking about these novels? Because the third one just came out in the United States. So can you sort of tell us what they're about and how you got started with them?
Yeah, sure. Well, actually, the way I got started with these books was I wanted to write a novel that was just for me. I wanted to write something really, really fun. It had everything I love. So it's got magic. It's got adventure. It's got this big, noisy family that's always interfering and getting in each other's way. But it's also set in Jane Austen's Regency, England. So it's got highwaymen and romance and balls and arranged marriages. And it's just ridiculously fun, and it's all told from the perspective of Cat Stevenson, who starts out the series 12 years old. She's the youngest sister, and she's busy having her own magical adventures while her older sisters are having the romances, which Cat occasionally has to step in and sort of maneuver and manipulate into her own.
And so do you have the first line memorized? Because it's like got to be one of the best first lines to a trilogy ever.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I think it's, I may, it's terrible, I may misphrase my own first line, but I was 12 years of age when I chopped off my hair, dressed as a boy, and set out to save my family from impending doom. I made it almost to the end of my front garden.
It's just a fantastic start to the series. And the thing that I really love about it is there's definitely the fantasy element there, but in many ways it's very straight-facedly Regency England. I mean, so you've kept it very true to the period, except for the magic stuff. And how did you go about doing that? I mean, because it's, whenever people write period pieces, just the tremendous research it takes to get every little detail, how do you even begin?
Well, I was lucky in that I had spent pretty much my whole life, not quite, but I think my dad read me Pride and Prejudice when I was 8 years old. So, you know, I had gotten started really early with the obsession. So, you know, I grew up reading Jane Austen obsessively, reading Georgette Heyer, all these Regency authors. Then just before I started writing the first Cat book, I was a PhD student at the University of Leeds, and I spent a lot of time in the Brotherton Graduate Library, and I was supposed to be working on my PhD thesis, which was about 18th century opera, but I quite often end up procrastinating by wandering around the 18th century and 19th century English lit stacks. And I read the diaries of, you know, Fanny Burney, Mary Shelley, I read biography after biography of all these women from the era, including Jane Austen. So by the time I actually started writing Cat, I had a really good general feel for the society. The time period, the attitudes, and then it was really a matter of just hunting down details. So, and one other thing I did was every morning before I started my writing session, I would spend 10 minutes just reading through Jane Austen's letters because I wanted to get a feel for the right, just the tone, the Cat's voice is not Jane Austen's voice by a long shot, but I wanted to get a feel for the time period and get that in my head before I started this writing session for the day.
And you can certainly, you know, it's not Jane Austen, but there's sort of an Austen-esque sort of feel to the entire thing. I mean, you can kind of hear shades of, well, it probably isn't shades of Jane Austen, but probably just sort of more being true to the period, but sort of in all the different characters, because you've got Cat, who's definitely an individual and definitely does her own thing. But there's also so many voices of society just sort of saying, no, you're supposed to do this and you're not supposed to do that. And it just seems to me you've got the tone perfect as far as that goes. Do you want to talk a little bit about the cast of characters?
Sure. Well, one of the things that inspired the books in the first place was, like I said, I've been obsessed with Jane Austen for a long time. And one of my favorites of her books is Sense and Sensibility. And I love the movie also, the Emma Thompson version. And in the book and in the movie, there's this great younger sister who's quite rebellious and not following along with what the older sisters want. But she's just a minor character. You know, she's sort of in there for humor and then she disappears. And this, what they focus on is the romance and the serious angsty stuff. And So I thought it'd be quite fun to write something that was a younger sister book. So we've got Kat, who is the very snarky 12-year-old youngest sister, looking at her older siblings with a kind of jaundiced eye. And then we've got the oldest, Charles, who is in a lot of trouble in book one. Charles has gone to Oxford and behaved very, very badly. He's gotten really into this very bad crowd of very wealthy young men. The family is not wealthy. Mm-hmm. I actually based the family, this family situation is based on Jane Austen's own family, mm-hmm. Okay. Which means that the father is a vicar. They're sort of accepted as genteel, mm-hmm. but they're on the lower rungs. Mm-hmm. And so Charles does not have the money for the kind of crowd he's running with at Oxford, and he ends up gambling the whole family into debt. And this sets off all the events of book one, as the family is desperately trying to find some way to stay out of debtor's prison. Mm-hmm. And the way that the family's stepmother comes up with to solve the problem is she's going to marry off the oldest sister, Alyssa. Mm-hmm. And Alyssa is such a saintly, you know, angelic kind of person in a way, that she's willing to go along with this to save the family. Right. She also likes being a gothic heroine. She kind of enjoys being a martyr. Right. And Kat and the other sister, Angelina, absolutely refuse to condone this. Mm-hmm. They're determined to come up with something else. So we've got Kat as the rebellious youngest sister. We've got Alyssa as the sort of saintly, very good girl, oldest mm-hmm. sister. And then there's Angeline. And Angeline is 5 years older than Kat. She's, I think, 17 in the first book. It's terrible, I don't remember completely.
And bring up quite the scandal of her own.
Yeah, and she is very strong-minded. Uh-huh. And the way she decides to deal with the situation is by pulling out their scandalous mother's old magic books mm-hmm. and becoming a witch. And things backfire very badly.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll not spoil that storyline, but that is hysterical. But, and then you want to talk a little bit about the magic system and how Kat gets herself all tangled up in all of this?
Well, in this version of Regency England, magic is the most shocking thing you could possibly do. It's completely scandalous. You will be thrown out of good society. And the magic that everybody knows about, even though it's so uncommon for it to be practiced in public nowadays, you know, young people might even think it's just a legend or mm-hmm. a rumor, is witchcraft. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out, and what I should say to start with is the problem for Kat's family ever since she was born is that her mother, who died in childbirth with her, mm-hmm. was a notorious witch. Mm-hmm. And so, as the wife of a vicar, that seriously spoiled his job prospects. Right. All of his career advancement, and it means the whole family is looked at in a very, very suspicious light mm-hmm. because that was such a scandalous thing. And she was a witch, she didn't bother to hide it mm-hmm. or didn't hide it well enough, and everyone knew. So when Kat's father remarried, the stepmother, who's very proper and determined to make the whole family acceptable again, she went through the house, took away mm-hmm. everything having to do with the scandalous late mother, locked it all up in a cabinet, including all the magic stuff, and forbade the daughters and the son to ever speak of their mother again. But after Angeline goes into the cabinet and pulls out the magic books and starts doing her own witchcraft, Kat thinks she might as well have a try also. Right. She goes in there and she finds out something she had no idea about, which is that there's a second system of magic. And this is guardian magic, which is actually more powerful in a lot of ways. It runs in the blood, just like witchcraft. But while every child of a witch has the natural ability to become a witch if they mm-hmm. want, there's only one child per generation who can be a guardian. There's a whole order, a very secretive order of guardians that has been formed specifically to protect the rest of British society from any malevolent magic workers. Mm-hmm. And Kat has inherited guardianship from her mother. Her mother was a guardian, but was kicked out for practicing witchcraft also. These are two competing kind of magical systems.
Right. And And what I thought was touching about that storyline is Kat didn't really get to know her mother because her mother passed away. And so this is sort of a connection that she has Absolutely. To this woman who obviously means so much to her, but who she doesn't really have in her life.
Absolutely.
You can see why Regency romance is so popular, because in a society with so many sort of, you know, strictures on it, the way people act out these intense emotions, you know, it just gets very interesting and very fraught and all of that. So
it's fun to play with a society that has so many rules. Because obviously there's the fun of watching people work around the rules, and there's the fun of watching people like Kat break them.
Right, with a sledgehammer. The beginning of the second book, when they're right into Bath, just all of the complications of, you know, how they dress and what kind of carriage they show up in and who they try to stay with and how they even navigate that situation. And what's funny about that, and what I'll share with people listening to this, is I read that book right before I read Northanger Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I did, because there are all these things in Northanger Abbey I probably wouldn't even noticed if I hadn't had it explained to me, like, what the pump room is and, you know, how... what was so popular about Bath that genteel families would go stay there for the healing properties of the water. And, you know, if I hadn't read the A Tangle of Magics before, I probably just wouldn't have even seen it. Because there's all this little, you know, it's sort of window dressing that you only really appreciate if you actually know the story behind it. So, yeah, anybody who's a Jane Austen fan, I highly recommend your books too, because it just shows you a whole other side of Jane Austen that you wouldn't know because you didn't live back then. I know you visited Bath and were, you know, in the pump room for...
I love Bath. I visited it as many times as I could rationalize. It's my favorite city in the world. I could live there very happily if it were a bit less expensive. The funny thing is, the first time I went to Bath, I was working on a completely different book. But it was set in the Regency era.
Mm-hmm.
And I only wanted to go to Bath because... there's this museum of historical costume there, and Patrick, my husband, who's also a writer, he came along very nicely, you know, and helped me make the notes on, you know, the historical costumes. But then he wanted to, just for fun, he wanted to go to the Roman baths, because he remembered being a kid, he grew up in the UK, unlike me, he remembered going to the museum of the Roman baths and thinking it was really cool. So I went along with him. I put away my notebook, because this was the bit that was just for fun.
Right.
And it turns out the Renegade Magic is all set really around the Roman baths, because I fell in love. It was such an incredibly magical place. It was just so ripe with story potential. And I spent the next 3 years cursing myself for not making notes on every single room or anything I went through.
Well, I mean, because on the cover of the second book in the U.S., she's standing in the baths, literally, in the water.
Yeah, and on the U.K. cover, she's running along by the water.
Yeah.
It's very central to the book. I've been back there many other times, and this time, you know, the second time that we went back, we brought a video camera, and I made a lot of notes.
Yeah. And what's nice about it is you get the exposition in there so nicely that for people who don't know the Regency era, it's quite accessible, you know, what's going on and what the significance of all of the societal strictures and everything are, and, you know, what the stakes are, because... like any Regency novels, getting people married off advantageously is kind of the central plot. I mean, you could almost say it's an A plot, because that's sort of what begins and ends a story. But what you follow is Kat just doing these wild and crazy things in the back, and having and duking out with major magical, you know, powers and things like that in the background, and, you know, her poor family know part of it, but they don't know the full extent of it by any means. And
absolutely.
Yeah, so
I'd be horrified if they did.
Yeah, it's very sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead kind of thing. But you also now have a short story about Kat available, and why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, that was one that I wrote between the first Kat book and the second Kat book. I wrote it before the second Kat book was published, and I also set it between the two books. It's called Dueling Magics, and it's just this fun story about Kat having sort of a magical duel and also a battle of wits with her older sister, Angeline, who is the witch. And, yeah, honestly, I wrote it pretty much just for fun, but I also did it for, there was a charity auction that people bid on various things, and one of the things they could bid on was the story, you know, having the story dedicated to them, you know, getting a copy ahead of everybody else. And so I did that. I dedicated it to wonderful reader, Becky Boyer. And then finally I ended up here up as an ebook, and it's free now on pretty much every ebook platform. I think Amazon in America and the UK, also Barnes & Noble. It's a Nook book in America and the UK. Mm-hmm. And it's also on Smashwords for free. So if anyone's outside America or they're Britain, they can still get it.
Yeah, and so then Smashwords should eventually distribute it to iBookstore and everywhere like that.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope it's already there. Yeah. I don't know.
Before we move on to talk about your short story career, I would like to spend a moment talking about the jewelry that we did for your cat books. And so I trained as a jewelry designer while I was just moving out to England, was it 3 years ago now? And I decided a good exercise would be, and possibly a good business venture, would be to do book tie-in jewelry. And so I contacted Stephanie because she's really, really nice and charitable and had these amazing books.
I should say this was not an act of charity. This was, I got that email and I was jumping up and down. I was really excited about it.
We had so much fun, I think, putting these pieces together. And so, yeah, so we designed together a whole sort of set of jewelry for these books. And so do you want to talk a little bit about the different pieces and everything?
Well, it was just so much fun. Emily is very kindly saying we designed together. I have no visual skills. what Emily did, which was wonderful, which was she asked me what was my dream jewelry themed with Kat. And I told her, obviously not be able to get visual details because I cannot design for the life of me. And she made it. And it's beautiful. So with the first book, there were actually two pieces of jewelry. There was one beautiful necklace. It's got a pendant. It's actually Kat's late mother's magic book. And the way we did it was we looked up a whole bunch of 18th century commonplace books to try to see what it might have really looked like. And you could probably talk more about that part, but I was just so excited because I put it on and it says magic on it with the CK spelling that Kat's mother would have used. And, you know, it's magic to me, honestly.
It was a lot of fun to make. It was that was a wax carved piece for anybody listening who's got any metalworking knowledge. So that was done with investment casting, as were the charms that we did on the charm bracelet.
Yeah, and that was really exciting. Was the this incredible charm bracelet that Emily made. That was my absolute sort of fantasy piece of jewelry. This charm bracelet that it's got both words and pieces that are important to the book. So there's a highwayman's mask, there's a key, you know, the key to Kat's mother's cabinet of secrets. This is the magic book, I think, and there's Kat's magic mirror. And there's also some tags with words, and the words add up to read "everything's better with highwaymen," which is the tagline that my agent used when he was sending out the book to publishers.
It's a good one. And well, and the thing about doing that piece of jewelry, anybody who knows anything about metals over the last few years, is we originally were going to do sterling silver because that's what charm bracelets were, and silver has just skyrocketed in price, so we ended up doing them in aluminum, which I think worked out really well because it actually shines up, you know, very, very pretty, and it's nice and lightweight, so it puts less stress on the chain and everything. So yeah, so those both had to do with the first book, and then because we had a bracelet and a necklace for the second book, we did earrings. We did earrings that were made to look like they were drops of water from the Roman baths, and they all have words in them.
Yeah, so, I love jewelry with words on it.
So
and the jewelry, the earrings for the second book, one earring says sisters, the other says friends. And it's sort of a theme of the book. It's friendship and sisterhood. And it's also quite literally, you know, there's the two big relationships in the book for Kat. So there's her sister, Angeline, who's the dynamic between Kat and Angeline is really important in that book. And also she does make a new really important friend who gets wrapped up in the magical bizarreness.
And so we did that one out of resin, and actually figured out exactly how difficult resin is to work with, because it was just disastrous. We finally, you know, the pieces that turned out well are on Amazon, They will be a limited edition, the resin versions of them. If they sell out, we'll replace them with another aluminum version that we've already designed together. And then for the final book, we did a ring.
Which is beautiful.
Yeah, we designed that in during EasterCon, sitting there in the children's playroom with little people screaming. Screaming and shrieking and running around. So yeah, why don't you explain about the witch's hearts and things that we used in the ring.
Yeah, well, the big symbol at the front of the ring is this curvy heart. It's a very distinctive curved shape, which is actually a really important symbol in jewelry, and jewelry from the time period. It's called the witch's heart. And over the centuries, it's been used in different ways. I own a brooch which a friend sent to me. It was actually made in 1803, the year of the first cat book. This is a really meaningful piece of jewelry to me. And brooches with the witch's heart shape were often pinned onto babies' blankets to protect them from evil spirits. But then over the years, there got to be a second meaning, which is even more commonly used by the early 19th century, late 18th century. A man might give a woman a piece of jewelry shaped like a witch's heart to mean, you have bewitched me. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, all in all, it was the perfect symbol for this series of books. Mm-hmm. I also really loved that the third cat book is centered around the wedding between cat sister Angeline and mm-hmm. Frederick Carlyle, mm-hmm. who was originally bewitched by Angeline. Quite literally.
Yes.
I thought for the ring that's themed in with their wedding, what better symbol could there be than a witch's heart?
Yeah. And the words on that one say every kind of magic, mm-hmm. because they're in that book. You really do see every kind of magic, and the rest of the meaning people will get when they read the book. But yes. Yeah. And so for that one, that one was investment cast in aluminum, and it was originally made out of fine silver. So I was able to do the texturing and to make the words look like they were engraved without actually having to do engraving. And I think that one turned out pretty well
as well.
And it's a wrap ring so that it can be worn, it'll fit any finger. So it's small enough that on an adult, it's probably most comfortably worn on like your pinky. But on a young girl, it could very comfortably be worn on the thumb. Mm-hmm. And so really any age can wear these rings. And yeah, so Stephanie put up with me trying all these different jewelry techniques and learning and sometimes succeeding and sometimes not, but...
I would put it that I was really incredibly lucky that a wonderful jeweler was interested in doing this for my books.
It was a lot of fun, and I wasn't able to grow my business the way I wanted to because the economy really hit the jewelry industry hard, but those pieces are out, and those are up on Amazon, and the very much made with love. Not only did Stephanie help me design these pieces, but I just absolutely love the Cat Stevenson books. So I'm so privileged, I think, to be able to do that. Now let's talk about your short story mm-hmm. career. You've had a long one. Now,
yeah.
When was your first short story published? It was quite a while ago. And to be fair, it was while she was a teenager, so I'm not saying she's really old.
Yeah, I'm 35 now, so it was a story I wrote 20 years ago when I was 15. I still say that was my first short story publication, because it was, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't put it in an adult collection. My first short story was, it was a gothic. I wrote it under the influence of Edgar Allan Poe. It was fun to write. It was set in France, where I'd never been, with lots of family curses. It was very melodramatic. Mm-hmm. And then I published another story just when I graduated from college in an anthology called Jewish Science Fiction mm-hmm. Fantasy, I think it was. No, Jewish Sci-Fi for Kids was the title of the anthology. And that was, again, historical, but I was starting to actually figure out how to write historical by then.
Right.
It was set in Prague in 19th century. And then after that, it was many, many years. I went to the Clearing West writing workshop with Emily.
Yeah, where we met.
Yeah, in 2001.
And if it seems like I interview a lot of my Clearing classmates, what can I say? They keep doing amazing things like winning awards and landing contracts with major publishers. So
Yeah, well, it was a great, amazing workshop because, for one thing, you know, it's the one time in my life I've actually been able to watch my writing actually improve within 6 weeks, because usually this is a really gradual process.
Yes, yeah.
But I got to actually watch it get better and better. We had the most amazing teachers. Made a lot of friends there. I met my now husband there.
Yes.
I lived in the UK because I met my husband there, and he's British. It was a very formative experience. But then after that, although I really learned how to write short stories there, I didn't start publishing them for, I think it was 2004 before I made my next real sale. So,
yeah.
Which felt a long time at the time.
Yeah.
But since then, it's been pretty regular. I've published just over 30 short stories now in various places.
Yeah, and I mean, when you started selling again, it was to a lot of the major markets at that point. You were starting to sell to Strange Horizons, and what? Where haven't you sold? I mean, you've sold to Beneath the Skies, you've sold pretty much all the...
I haven't sold to.
Okay, so, but yeah, most of the major publications, you'll see a story by Stephanie in it. Watching everybody's writing during Clarion West Improve was pretty amazing, but it was particularly disgusting that in the last week you were able to have this story that had the climax in flashback told by one of the characters and have that totally work, which is, you know, showing skills that I don't think I'll ever have, but,
I don't know about that.
So you've been publishing short stories for quite a while, but you've been writing novels also for quite a while, and, you know, not to make an exhibit of your career or anything like that, but I think you are also a very good example of how incredibly talented people, how it still just takes a really long time sometimes to break in.
Time. It really does.
And, you know, because you sold your novel trilogy at what age?
I was 31 when I sold it.
Which, you know, comparatively among writers is fairly young, but also most writers don't really get started as young as you do. I mean, you were, like we've said, you were publishing things when you were in your teens. You've written how many novels before you got that trilogy published?
Trying to remember the exact number, but I hate to say it, I think it was somewhere between 8 and 10, which makes new writers just...
Yeah, just want to cry. Yeah.
But, you know, I learned something from every single novel, and that's something I was talking to another writer about, Justina Robson, who coincidentally is also another Clarion West grad, not from a different year than ours. And we were agreeing that although both of us wrote a lot of novels before we started getting any published, there wasn't a single novel we'd written that we regretted in hindsight,
because
every single one takes you on an emotional journey as you write it. Every single one makes you a better writer, especially if you take the time to revise it. Yeah, so I'm happy to have written every single one, although I wouldn't want to publish any of the older ones now.
Yeah, so my older ones would definitely be blackmail material. And so your novels were picked up by Athenaeum in the United States and Tumblr Publishing in the UK. And then are there any other editions, like foreign language editions?
My first foreign language edition is coming out this month, and May 10th it's coming out in France. It's I'm going to butcher the title if I try to pronounce it. Sounding it out phonetically as someone who doesn't speak French, I'm going to say it's Cat Apprenti Magicien.
Oh, okay.
Basically, it looks to me as Cat Apprentice Magician.
Right.
And cover is gorgeous. I cannot wait to hold a copy in my hands, and it makes me want to learn French.
Very cool. You're currently working on another project that you're rewriting, even this very day before this interview. Is there anything you can share about it yet, or how much of it is still under wraps?
Well, it's the tentative working title, which I have to say, I've never had any luck in guessing at real titles as I'm writing.
Yeah.
The first cat book, I called it Cat by Moonlight when I sold it.
Uh-huh.
It went multiple titles.
Yeah, Cat by Moonlight, Cat by Starlight, Cat by Ghost Starlight was the original trilogy title. Yeah.
It went through multiple titles in the U.S. before finally my sales team, who is very smart, decided on Cat Incorrigible.
Uh-huh.
Or A Most Improper Magic in the U.K.
Mm-hmm.
So, taking this title with a grain of salt, the current project is called Antonia O'Toole Takes the Low Road to Hollywood.
Oh, okay.
It's set in the early 1930s. It's a screwball kind of comedy road trip with ghosts and gangsters, and it's got a lot of my own family history worked into it. So, it was a fun book to write. It was also a really hard book to write because I was working in lots of personal stuff, and it's quite emotional.
Uh-huh.
And also, I have to say, it was a lot easier to research Regency England, living in England.
Yes.
To research 30s America, living in Wales. But it was really worth it. It was, I'm crossing my fingers for it. It's supposed to go out to submission this month. The nice thing is, I actually wrote it I got paid to write it because I won a bursary from Literature Wales, which is a wonderful arts organization here in Wales, and they give children's writers bursaries. And so it was a fabulous boost in confidence when I, you know, I sent them the first two chapters and a synopsis, and they said yes. So I thought, right.
Very nice. Yeah, you know, sort of put that in perspective. That's how J.K. Rowling was able to afford to write Harry Potter. She won a bursary as well up in Scotland. And the UK is very supportive of the arts in that respect. And Stephanie now is a dual citizen. But I realize we haven't actually told people anything about your background. Hearing us talk, I'm sure everybody can tell we're both Americans. Stephanie's originally from Michigan and was a professional musician. Before she got into the writing.
Yeah, and then I actually switched over to academics. And I did a master's degree in music history and studied music history in Vienna, and then ended up doing a PhD program at University of Leeds and never ended up finishing the PhD because I ended up doing too much time looking at the 18th century English stacks instead.
And selling novels to major publishers and things like that.
Yeah, that ended up taking over the focus. But the reason I had gone across the world for my PhD was meeting my husband, Patrick Samphire, at Clarion West in Seattle. And I moved, we sort of made a deal. He would move anywhere in England if, you know, I would go to school in England. So I got into University of Leeds, the fellowship. He moved up to Leeds from Bristol. And I'm now a dual citizen. And we moved down to Wales a couple of years ago, which is really incredibly beautiful. And my son is growing up bilingual in English and Welsh, which is very cool.
Yeah. You went all the way through, almost through a PhD. You started selling novels to a major publisher. But then you also had health issues.
Yes.
That, did that also help put an end to your PhD studies, or was that?
It was certainly a big part of it. I had, after the first 3 years of my PhD, I ran out of funding because I'd gotten 3 years of funding, and I'd written half of my PhD dissertation at that point, but I got a full-time job. My original plan was I was going to work a full-time job and work on my novels and do the PhD thesis, and that was a little overambitious, and I chose the novels that year. I said, but I talked to my supervisor, we did an extension, and I had not actually officially given up the PhD. My hope was to be able to still finish it just over a much longer period. And unfortunately, not too long after I started that job, it was 2005, I got very sick. It was a very mysterious kind of illness. I was just, I was really, really weak, dizzy, had a hard time doing anything. I had a hard time even thinking. I spent a lot of time just lying in, on the couch because I couldn't walk. Doctors couldn't diagnose it. It was really, it was very horrible. This was 2 years on and off. First I switched down to part-time, my day job, and then I ended up having to quit basically before I could be fired for spending too long sick. And around the time I quit, I was finally diagnosed with what in America it's called chronic fatigue syndrome. In the UK, it's myalgic encephalomyelitis, I should say. ME is how I usually talk about it. And it was really horrible because I'd spent the whole last 2 years thinking, soon the doctors will find a diagnosis and then they'll give me medicine and then I'll be better again. And they'll help me again. And they finally did a diagnosis, and they said, you will never be better again, basically. Statistically, most people who get better from CFS or ME get better within the first 2 years. And if you haven't, then you're very unlikely to.
And you've had it now at this point for?
Yeah, it's been 8 years now. And so that was a really difficult time for me, to say the least. I had to give up my job. I wasn't bringing in any money, obviously. I didn't know how my future was going to work. I was married to Patrick, who was wonderful and supportive, but I hated not being able to bring in any income, not being able to, I felt like, you know, pull my part of the load, you know, as a, as a partner. And I should say again, that was all me. And that was, Patrick was just amazing.
Yeah.
And has continued to be.
Yeah, well, Patrick, as long as I've known him, has been overjoyed to have Stephanie Burgess in his life.
Well, thank you. I feel the same. But, yeah, so the funny thing is, I had been writing novels before this, of course. The last two novels I'd written had been adult historical fantasy, somewhat darker, angsty, right, adult historical fantasy. I got an agent for my first one. Mm-hmm. It went on submission, got very close, kept going to acquisitions, getting turned out in the last moment. So I thought, so here's, this is my career path. Uh-huh. And then I got it to this illness, and I was in such despair. I thought, I can't write this stuff because I am so depressed right now. Mm-hmm. I need to write something that's going to make me feel better. I can't write dark, angsty things. Mm-hmm. I need to write something that will give me some joy. So I started writing Cat, and honestly, when I started writing the first Cat book, I knew, I really thought I knew that it would never sell because it was too quirky, mm-hmm. it was too individual to me, mm-hmm. it was just the book I wanted to read, who else would want to read this, you know, but it made me happy, and I was so sick for a lot of that first Cat book. I wrote a lot of it just lying on the couch, but I might be stuck on the couch all day. But Cat gets to jump on a highwayman's horse, right. And, you know, they break all the rules and do wild magic, and yeah. Cat saved me. Cat completely mm-hmm. saved me, and it saved me emotionally, and then ended up, I have to say, saving us financially too, mm-hmm. because much to my shock, the trilogy sold and sold really well, and
well, and it landed you a major agent. I mean, you'd had one agent before. Here's also, aspiring writers really hate to hear these stories, I know. But, you know, having multiple agents before you sell. But, yeah, it landed you a very high-powered agent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had one agent for my adult books. We ended up parting amicably. And, so that was another thing to add into the feeling, the sense of despair. Right, and yes. Yes. Because I thought, oh my God, you know, and I don't even have an agent anymore.
Right.
You know, I will never get another agent. I will never sell anything, right. Et cetera, et cetera. So, yes. And then Kat got me a really fantastic agent and who really believed in the book and mm-hmm. sent it out and got multiple offers. Mm-hmm. And suddenly my life was very different. You know, it wasn't J.K. Rowling different, but it was very different from what it had been.
Right.
And, so I was incredibly lucky, and then it sold in the UK a year later, and, it really turned my life around. I do still have ME, and it's still a major life issue for me, but it just, not only did switching what I wrote change my emotional attitude in a lot of ways, it made mm-hmm. me just a happier person, but also, it's also took away some of the terror that the ME hmm. had given me, because it is terrifying when you're no longer physically able to go out to work and you think, what am I going to do for my whole life? You know, right. How am I going to survive it? How will we survive financially? You know, right. What's going to happen?
Well, and it's important that, you know, people with these chronic conditions hmm. are open about it, because unfortunately ME, you know, has a lot of people are quite skeptical of mm-hmm. it as a condition. And you and I have talked about how sometimes if the condition has a name that's in English, mm-hmm. people kind of think it's made up. But if you translate it to Latin, oh yeah, no, that's serious.
But, you know, absolutely. Well, it's one of the reasons why people hate, you know, people with CFS hate the term chronic fatigue syndrome. Because people who don't have it listen to that and think, well, I get tired. Everyone gets tired. You work through it.
Yeah, right.
And that is just, it has nothing to do with the experience of CFS. This, where your muscles will not work,
right.
And you get brain fog, and it's complete physical. Sometimes when I've had really bad crashes, I've had times when I've fallen. Like mm-hmm. I can't walk, fall right. over, can't get off the floor. It's just horrible. It's a really nasty, horrible condition. It's now, at this point, the medical community is all saying, you know, in all the official documents and everything, this is a very real disease. But the first time I ever heard of it, I was a teenager, and I was reading, I think my parents got the New York Times, so this is a major paper, for reading this very sarcastic essay about yuppie flu that people like to imagine they have. And I remember laughing at it because the writer was very funny and very scathing. And it never occurred to me that I would ever have this illness and that it was real and just how scary it is to find out that your whole life has changed. I used to hike. I loved doing massive hikes and walking, and I jogged. And yeah, I'm quite lucky now that the ME has gotten a lot better than it once was. But, you know, it being better still means I have to make decisions about my energy every day. You know, if I go to town and walk around today, this means that tomorrow I'm going to be lying down all day to make up for it. You know, these kind of calculations go on every single day.
And it's still somewhat of a mystery, is it, in the medical community, what causes it?
Yeah, it's very difficult. They keep coming up with different theories, which tend to keep being disproven. There's a lot of controversy over how to spend the money, because lingering from that original attitude that it was kind of this imaginary illness, that meant that all the money was being pumped into psychological research, which has all come out absolutely useless. Because it's not imaginary. And unfortunately, there hasn't been enough money yet put into biomedical research, and there's starting to be right now, but it's going to be a long time before, I think, people come up with anything, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I guess what a lot of people don't realize about chronic fatigue syndrome or ME is that it's not just physical energy. It's not just that you can't run marathons. It even would impact your writing, your ability to parent your children, and things like that. I mean, all of these things use energy, and I think oftentimes people don't realize.
And it's mental energy, also. You can't focus too long at a time, which makes it very difficult. And you need to balance rest and energy mentally as well as physically. And so it's a, you know, it's frustrating, because there are times, like when I'm doing this rewrite, all I would like to do is work on rewriting my book. I've got this deadline. It's very important to me. And also it's I find it easier to do rewrites if you can really get the whole book in your head and work on it pretty much nonstop till it's finished. And I can't, because I can't focus for that long at a time. It has to be very concentrated sessions.
Yeah, and so writers will, you know, sort of know that feeling when, you know, you're in the final rewrites and you're pulling all-nighters and you're about to crash. Imagine feeling that many hours earlier. You know, not being able to do the, you know, 24 or 30-hour writing sessions that a lot of us do.
What actually happens is the brain fog comes in and start to feel dizzy and literally get to the point of not being able to think, not being able to come up with the right words, you know, to speak properly. You know, it can be a really scary feeling.
Well, and one of the things about being open about having, you know, what's functionally a disability is that on the one hand, you do have a very full life. And you really have made it work very well for yourself. But at the same time, I think people sometimes see this full life that you have, and they don't fully appreciate all of the little choices that you have to make every day to make that possible. I mean, because you've got one child, you've got another one on the way, you've got a successful writing career, you've got a successful marriage to a husband who just sold one of his novels. Two of his novels to Macmillan. I mean, you know, and these are things that are hard to do without CFS. And with CFS, I think a lot of people just don't realize just all the little bargains you kind of have to make to get through the day.
Absolutely. And a lot of it is, I think, invisible. It's like, you know, I might have to be in the house pretty much all week except for one day in a week. But, you know, people will see me out and about that day.
Right.
And, you know, online, you know, because a lot of my career is conducted online. You know, of course, no one sees any of that.
Right.
So it would be easy never to talk about it. The reason I talk about it is because I think more people need to talk about ME. And it meant a lot to me when I found out that one of my favorite writers, Robin McKinley, has ME, and she's talked about it very openly on her blog. And that really, it really inspired me. It helped me realize it was possible to have, you know, this wonderful career, and also it just helps to know if someone you admire who's dealing with the same issues that you are. And actually, I got an email last week through my website that really, really moved me, and it made me realize again how important it is to be open about this stuff. because it was from a girl who has been a fan of the cat books all throughout, but had never looked at my website or found out anything about me until she finished the third book. And then she went on the website just to find out if it was May 4th, which sadly there isn't. But
yet.
Yeah. But she saw on the website what I'd written about the Emmy, and it made a huge difference to her because here's this 16-year-old girl who's been suffering from Emmy for the last few years, and to actually find out about an adult having, you know, a happy adult life and a career while dealing with the ME, that was incredibly important to her. Mm-hmm. And I think it's too tempting sometimes to present only a happy version of our life that doesn't include any of the really difficult bits.
Yeah.
And yeah, for me, it's important to talk about the health bits too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really admire you for doing that. Because, you know, I know it's got to make a difference to a lot of people. Is there anything else that I haven't covered that you specifically wanted to talk about or share with all the Buttgate viewers?
I don't have anything, but I'm really happy that you invited me to do this. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time.